Hi, I'm Gary Bowerman from Check In Asia.
And I'm Hannah Pearson from Pat Anderson.
And this is the Southeast Asia Travel Show.
Hello, wherever you are in the world, and thank you for listening in to part two of our 20 for the 2020s Travel Wishlist podcast.
Yes, Hannah and I both selected 10 top travel hopes and desires for the new decade, and we mixed them up and put them into a combined hit list. The 20 for the 20s wish list that we've put together is not ranked in any particular order.
Nope.
And part one of our show featured some range of topics, including me ranting on a couple of things. But we actually also discussed building more airports like Changi in Singapore, making Muslim travel more mainstream, and developing better rail connectivity for travelers in Southeast Asia.
So stay tuned as we discuss our bunch of travel wishes, which will include Gary getting vocal again about online shopping festivals, an inventive new fusion of restaurants and airlines, and a plea for us all to please take travel health seriously. So let's crack on. Part two of our 20 for the 2020s travel wish list and one of Gary's selections. Number 11. Travel consumers take more responsibility, less unthinking tourism. I think we can all relate to that concept, but how can travel behaviours be changed?
It's a very, very good question, and it's one that is making waves in the very highest level of the tourism industry, particularly in Asia, as we're seeing a rising demand for travel.
Yes.
This idea actually emanated two or three months ago. I was invited by Channel News Asia to speak on the issue of Uluru or Ayers Rock, when the ban was instituted about climbing Ayers Rock. And the reason the ban was instituted is that local indigenous populations don't like people to travel because it's a sacred site. They've been asking people not to climb Uluru for a long time now. But now there's actually an official ban. They're not saying don't visit. You can still go and enjoy what is a beautiful site. And it's a very spiritual site. It feels very spiritual. But they're saying just don't climb it. And I thought that what we're seeing around the world is hopefully this move towards a better understanding of local peoples, local cultures, and trying to understand not just the backstories of why it's important to travel there, but why sometimes it's important not to do certain things. Now, this is obviously a wish list item because with mass tourism, people do tend to crowd to sites. They do tend to want to get the best pictures. They do tend to want to get the best view. And that's going to happen. But I would like to hope that over the next 10 years, the next decade, that travelers come to the conclusion that the people that we're traveling to visit or to see are just as important as we are as travelers ourselves, and we'd have to treat the landscapes and the people and the cultures and the cuisines with due respect. I think we do tend to see that quite a lot, but obviously the media picks up on the examples where it's not happening, and then we get the scare factor, and then you tend to get, you know, this sort of anti-tourism rhetoric. But it's going to be a bigger issue as we see more pockets of the world experiencing local tourism.
Yeah, and actually feeding into that, even just this morning, I was reading an article on Boston Globe that said, should all tourists have to obey a charter of behaviour that they should commit to before they're allowed to travel to any country? So I think this is going to be a big debate going on this decade.
I mean, China tried to do this a little bit a few years ago. I think it was 2013. It instituted a tourism law where it would actually, it was able to name and shame and actually restrict travellers from going overseas if they did commit offences against local rules or local. But we do tend to see some rather stupid behaviours. We've seen it in Southeast Asia. We've seen people dancing outside temples, you know, taking naked selfies on the tops of mountains and that kind of thing. It's just not necessary. And let's just think a little bit before we act.
Yes, I think so.
So moving on, that's another of my rants. We're coming to the next item, which is item 12. And this is one of your picks, Hannah. So you've said, and it's on a similar theme, Southeast Asian travellers should leave their phones behind and see where it takes them. Now that sounds controversial. Are you going to rant here?
I mean, of course, you can't really leave your phone behind nowadays. But I think, well, there's two elements to this, really. One is, of course, just being glued to your phone and only going to places that so you can take a photo of it and say that you've been rather than not really experience it. And the other is, I think you lack a bit of spontaneity.
Yeah.
And I think travel is always, you know, the best travel is about spontaneity and it's about serendipity and it's going to discover things.
Yeah.
And when you're just on your phone and you're being told you should go to this place, and then this place, you kind of lose that. You don't think, oh, maybe I'll go down this little lane and see where that takes me. You know, you just follow Google Maps to get there.
Yeah. And even if you do go down that little lane, you take a picture and then everybody else follows their phone and goes back there anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
It's self-fulfilling. But I tend to agree with you. I think one of the issues with phones is just how much of the travel experience has graduated onto the phones. Mm-hmm. I mean, we were talking, I think, in one of our pilot shows, I used to write travel guides.
Yeah.
You know, travel guides used to hold in your hand, used to thumb through them, you used to use the map. That's all graduated onto the phone now.
Yeah.
The booking element has gone onto the phone. You know, a lot of hotels are offering e-concierge services, which go direct to your phone now.
Yeah.
So it really has become the tool to do everything.
Yes.
And people just seem very lost without it because so much of what you do is on there now. Nobody carries a map anymore. Nobody actually has a big map of the city anymore.
Yes.
And something's a little bit lost with that.
Yeah, I mean, of course you've got more convenience and you've got the phone and things.
Of course.
I do miss that kind of element of the unknown, I guess, and going around with the guidebook in hand.
Yeah. So maybe we could go somewhere between. You can carry your phone, but keep your eyes open.
Yes, let's do that.
Should we go with that?
Lift your eyes up from the screen. Yeah.
And so our next one, number 13, is another of, well, I think there are only two or three items where we actually overlapped on our 20 for the 2020s wish list. And Hannah, so you wrote Greater Intra-ASEAN Travel, Forging Deeper Links and Leaving China and India Aside.
Yeah.
And I wrote More Attention Paid to Domestic Travel Trends. So there is an overlap here.
There is.
So who's up first, me or you? I vote you.
I was going to vote you. I mean, I think Greater Intra-ASEAN Travel, it's all about deepening those kind of links between the region. And even this week, ASEAN nations have kind of announced that they're releasing all of these joint travel packages as well to encourage that intra-ASEAN travel, more for medium and long haul into the region.
ASEAN smiles.
Yeah, something like that. But, you know, there's so much on your doorstep. And it's also, you know, climate crisis again, but why not explore more short-haul destinations rather than having to go to the other side of the world.
Yeah.
There's such a range of ASEAN places here. So much to discover, so many different kinds of things. That why not focus on intra-regional rather than looking for all of these big, kind of very demanding travel markets, China and India, who come and make their mark. So that was my little thought about it.
Yeah, I think this is perhaps one of our wishes that is hopefully going to come true.
Mm.
I think we've seen over the last few years that there is a growth of people from within the region traveling within the region.
Yes.
And obviously a lot of that has been facilitated by more flights between the countries, more flights within countries as well. So it's easier to travel domestically. Mm. My point about paying more attention to domestic travel trends is I think there are three things that are opening up.
Mm.
And will continue to open up this decade. One is international travel from within the region. That's going to continue.
Yeah.
Intra-regional travel, I think that's also going to continue.
Yeah.
And those tend to take a lot of the data, kind of the way that travel is evolving now. Mm-hmm. A lot of the trends and the data is coming from those outlets, so outbound travel and intra-regional. But domestic travel is also growing very, very fast in pretty much all countries of the region.
Yes.
And the interesting thing about domestic travel is that it tends to be a primer for the way people behave when they go overseas.
Mm.
So they're learning experiences. Perhaps in some countries they haven't really traveled into nature before.
Yeah.
Perhaps you're staying at a higher grade of hotel than ever before.
Mm.
Maybe you're taking short-haul flights, which is a precursor to mid-haul flight. So they really are sort of kind of a training ground for tourism, domestic travel. The other thing that I think that is very interesting is that in some of the countries, the spending power is rising.
Yes.
So the spending that's actually being used on domestic tourism is probably going to grow quite significantly.
Yes.
So travel providers around the world need to look at the way budgets are allocated for domestic travel.
Yeah.
And how that would vary compared to regional travel or international travel. I think there's a lot of data from domestic travel that probably isn't being used to its full potential.
Yeah, I think so. On to number 14. And Gary, you've chosen no to commoditizing travel through online shopping festivals. Do I detect another rant coming up?
Yes, well, perhaps. One of the problems that with the online shopping festivals we've seen are developing very, very fast in this region. We have the Singles Day, 11-11, which came from China.
Yes.
We have 12-12. Black Friday from America has also started to make inroads here. It's a really, really commoditizing retail. You know, everything is discounted.
Yep.
And it means that huge proportions of people's actual consumer or retail spend is very concentrated in a certain period.
Mm-hmm.
And it always is focused on discounted products.
Yes.
Now, if travel goes that way, it will really be difficult for the travel sector, because if travel just keeps discounting, we're going to encourage mass volume tourism.
Yeah.
And also, a lot of travel providers are going to go bust because they just won't be able to sustain it.
Yeah.
Travel is a year-round
part
of lives. Yeah. It's increasingly intrinsic to the lifestyle in Asia.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very important. Mm-hmm. People travel at different times of the year. But if you only buy discounted flights or hotel bookings or whatever, I think we're in for big problems over the next decade. And I think it will really skew the flows of travel.
Yeah.
So let's hope it doesn't do that. Unfortunately, around travel time, around particularly Singles Day last year, you get a lot of phone messages, you get a lot of emails from travel brands, airlines offering special discounts. Let's hope it doesn't go down that
road. Yeah, I mean, it kind of trains the consumer to always buy at a discount, right? You never want to buy at full price.
Yeah, yeah, I agree with that. So, number 15, and this one is yours, and we are both in agreement on this, even though it was your choice. Hannah, you've written A Comeback of the Travel Agent, Simplifying the Conundrum of Too Much Information. Now, I would say thumbs up for travel agents. We'll always support that. But how can we ensure that travel advisors stay relevant in what really is a very digitized industry?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, there is so much information out there. And of course, people can very easily put together their own tour packages online. But where a travel agent, I think, can really excel and where they've still got a place in the 2020s is for that difficult travel, the complicated itineraries, perhaps more high-end ones, where people just don't have the time actually to go through all of that information. They might have the money, they can afford to you know, buy it all online, but they just need somebody to actually sift through that information and give them a qualified, you know, kind of expertise on the destination, which is what travel agents have.
Yeah.
So, you know, what I would like to see in the 2020s is travel agents moving away from kind of this mass market FIT stuff and more towards the more complicated, where they can add value, I think. And I think that's how they can stay relevant and that's how they can survive in this digital
age.
Do
you think they'll move more into niche segments? So like you've seen in America, there are specialist cruise agents, you have specialist Caribbean agents, you have specialist European agents. Do you think that's the way it will work? Or
I think eventually it will have to.
Yeah.
I think so. Because if you are just mass market and you're giving information on everything, the level of information you're probably giving is what somebody could find online.
Yeah.
I think where you would really, you know, for example, in the US or the UK, where you would really go to a travel agent is where you know that they've got that in-depth knowledge and know-how and the insider tips.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that's where it's going
to
go.
And you work very closely with the travel trade. Mm. You talk to a lot of travel agents all the time, particularly in Malaysia, but also around the region.
Yeah.
What did you notice in 2019 that it was still strong? Did you notice there was still demand for travel agents?
Yeah, I mean, I think for Southeast Asia in general, there is still a need for travel agents. I think if you're looking at more developed markets like Singapore and Malaysia, again, where you don't need visas for a lot of countries, you're seeing more of a move towards FIT. People are booking by themselves. They feel more confident. And there isn't that language barrier as well, actually, because they generally speak English, so they can browse websites and everything much better.
Yeah.
I think for those markets which are non-English speaking, where they do still need visas, they may still rely more on travel agents because they know that they can find the information for them.
Yeah.
They can be assured that they're booking something
good
and they know how to handle all the visa applications.
Yeah. And one of the things we discussed in our pilot show was from our experiences at ITB Asia last year, is that we noticed there were a lot of new and exotic destinations that were starting to promote into Southeast Asia.
Exactly.
For the first time or they're relatively new at doing so.
Yeah.
I guess that's where travel agents can really add value because they are unknown. There's very little information known about this for travelers and they want to go and have things during their trip that are seamless, but they may also want to visit two or three new destinations at one time.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's where a travel agent can really come into its own with that kind of advice and knowledge.
So niche sectors, multi-destination packages, and expertise.
Yes.
Good. Thumbs up for travel agents.
So 16, this is a marketing issue, really. Let's stop pretending about personalized, pleads Gary. What's that all about?
Yeah, it is a marketing issue. Personalized travel has become a buzzword. It's become overused and it's become misapplied in many instances. And at the moment, it is really moving into the category of boutique or luxury, where it almost becomes meaningless.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't doubt that travel consumers, particularly younger consumers, do want some of the advertising, some of the marketing targeted roughly at their own behaviors, particularly their browsing behaviors, their app behaviors.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of data you use on your lifestyle services or your ride hailing or even booking flights now that can be used to target promotions towards you.
Absolutely.
The problem is the travel industry doesn't tend to do marketing that well beyond the browsing sphere.
Yes.
So email, for example, you know, I get a lot of emails where my name is spelt wrong. You know, one of the issues in Asia, for example, is where the surname and the first name are transposed.
Yeah.
And that's not a big issue unless you actually accept that that isn't personalized. If you're getting that wrong, you're simply just using an algorithm that doesn't actually pick up personal details.
Yeah.
And the other thing that really, really gets me is that sometimes you get asked for, you take a tour and they say, we want to make it as personalized for you as possible.
Yeah.
And the options that basically are, what's your dietary requirements, blah, blah, blah. Now that's fine, but that isn't really personalized. That's checklist.
Yeah.
And that's standard service. Yeah. That's standard travel service. It's always been there. So I don't really think that's personal. I just think there's a misapplication of personalization.
Yeah.
At the luxury end, you know, a lot of tours, a lot of hotel packages, they are being tailored very, very specifically to couples or to small groups or even to individual travelers. And that, I think, is personalized.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we have to get away from this mass idea that we can all be personalized travelers, because I just don't think it's actually feasible. And I don't think the travel industry is really well set up to do that.
No, I think you're right. I think it will take a lot more understanding and know-how about how to use data sets before even anywhere near it.
Yeah.
And it's such a buzzword.
We're a long way for that. Yeah, I think that's the problem. Is it matching data capabilities with actual personalized functionality?
Yeah.
That's a big
mismatch.
A big mismatch, yeah. So number 17. Hannah, this one's for you. And this is a neat twist on something that happened quite recently in Malaysia. So you've written, Hannah, restaurant chains to open up airlines. Now, please explain. Is that a dream? Is that a possibility? Or is that both?
Oh, wow. This one's a little bit tongue-in-cheek, really. But last year, 2019, AirAsia opened up their restaurant, Santan, which is based on their in-flight catering. And it's garnered a huge amount of press worldwide, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's
brilliant PR.
Brilliant PR. Amazing PR. For me, it's a little bit, I mean, I've eaten the food on AirAsia. I don't think it's that great to set up a restaurant, but hey, maybe I'm wrong, maybe I just ate the wrong things. But I just thought, imagine McDonald's open up their own airline, KFC next, you
or
know?
A Michelin starred airline. That would
that would probably work.
That would be a bit niche, but maybe.
Yeah, so a little bit of a silly one, that one, but who knows, right?
There was a trend 10, 15 years ago where some of the upper echelon airlines were hiring sort of Michelin-starred celebrity chefs to produce menus for them.
Yeah.
The only problem with that is you can produce a menu, but then it's got to be replicated day in, day out, which is difficult given the restrictions of...
That you're on a plane. Yeah.
That you're on a plane, yeah, exactly. And also they tend to be produced in a big mass kitchen.
Yes.
But there was that trend, but I haven't heard too much about that.
No.
I remember I was in Shanghai once and Gordon Ramsay came and did a promotion. Mm. I can't remember which airline that was for, but again, garnered great PR, great press, but then it sort of
tapered off. Let's see what happens 2020. McDonald's Air coming McDonald's to you
Air.
Soon.
Brilliant, 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 brilliant.
Three more travel wishes to go now. Our 18th hot pick is travelers being encouraged to get around destinations by public transport.
Yeah, we in our previous part one of this 20 of the 2020th show, we discussed greater connectivity by rail within Southeast Asia, which I think is a travel wish list that we really, 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 really hope happens. And it takes a lot of investment, but by the end of the decade, let's hope that there is better options for rail travelers. But there are other ways of traveling around this region. You know,
absolutely.
The old days of backpacking was coach-based.
Yeah.
And some of the luxury coaches now are pretty good.
Pretty nice.
For budget travelers.
Yeah.
They offer good services. Between some of the larger countries, which are archipelagos, so Philippines, Indonesia, to the Thai islands,
you
can travel by boat.
Yeah.
Always popular, but often goes under the radar a little bit. And obviously now we have ride hailing everywhere, so you can go around by car. But it would be nice to see more people traveling overland.
Yeah.
Because you get such a different perspective. And
it is.
We have such beautiful landscapes here. It would be nice to have the options to travel more overland.
Yeah, and I mean, and I think you really, like you say, you see a different side of the country, but you also get that extra chance to interact with the locals as well, don't you? And see what local life is like on public transport. Yeah. And that's always fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah, it does come back to rail travel. I mean, some of the great rail journeys around the world, you stop at various points on the road where, on the rails, where people come on board and try to sell you foods and drinks. You know, that's a real part of the cultural experience.
Yeah.
It would be great if we could have more of that in Southeast Asia. I took the train once from, this is many years ago, I took the train from Yangon in Myanmar to Bagan.
Mm-hmm.
Which is overnight, a long, long journey, and it's very, very rickety.
Mm.
But that train does stop in several places en route, and you get people coming on board and offering foods. And you stop at these very small, dusty train stations in the middle of nowhere, and it just feels great. You know, you just feel like you're in the middle of nowhere, which you actually are.
An adventure.
An adventure. Mm-hmm. And travel is an adventure, right?
It is.
Yeah. So we have two to go, and our penultimate theme. This comes down to money. Now, this is a very interesting one, Hannah. You wrote, by the end of the decade, you'd like to see a single currency across Southeast Asia. So there's no need to have drawers full of weird and wonderful coins and banknotes. So what's wrong with individual currencies, Hannah?
Well, I mean, nothing really. But it's just, it'd be so convenient, wouldn't it? You know, just to have that one currency. But when you look into it, in reality, you know, you've got such different economies, and even implementing the euro in the eurozone, they've had so many issues because you've got very disparate economies, Germany versus some of the kind of ex-Soviet bloc countries.
Greece, of course, Greece, which suffered, yeah.
And in Southeast Asia, the disparity is even greater, you know, Singapore versus Myanmar, for example. So I think we're a long way off.
Yeah.
That ever happening.
I tend to agree. And I think it would be nice. I have two things to say on that. One, I think, you're right. The political issue and the economic issue is just too much.
Yeah.
You'd have to have an ASEAN central bank, which I don't think is going to happen.
No.
You'd have to have an ASEAN monetary policy, which again isn't going to happen.
No.
And I don't think that actually any of the individual countries want this. I think,
I think the
version of ASEAN is very different to the EU. I think they wanted to move away from some of the strictures that the EU imposed on some of the countries.
Yeah.
And while I also think that traveling around the countries of Southeast Asia, there is this sort of loose ASEAN identity, but national identities are much stronger.
For sure.
Much stronger.
Yes.
And I think probably always will be.
I think so.
And also, on this point, I would hate to see Myanmar lose its own currency, because it's absolutely beautiful. Mm. The Chiat, I think you pronounce it, or Jat, is one of the most picturesque, beautiful currencies I've seen. And that reminds me, actually, just before the euro came into circulation, which I think was 2002,
something like that.
I was actually in Amsterdam,
and
I remember one night I'd been out, and I was staying in this annex, roof annex of the B&B, and it had this skylight, beautiful skylight. Shafts of light came through in the morning, and there were some guilders, Dutch guilders, on the floor, which had fallen out of my pocket, and the shafts of light just caught them, and these guilders had these beautiful dark blue, orange. And they were very colourful. It was a beautiful currency.
Mm.
And I think this was about 2 months before the euro came into circulation. And I just thought, that will be gone forever. That's a shame.
Yep.
Now, I know that when you cross borders, it then, particularly in ASEAN, because we have some currencies where the denominations just vary so much.
Yeah.
You know, some countries are using thousands just to buy small items. But I kind of like that, I have to admit.
So that brings us to our 20th and final travel wish for the new decade. which is really prioritizing health and safety in travel. Gary, that was your concluding contribution to the list.
And I didn't want to end on too much of a gloomy note, but we are approaching the Chinese New Year period, mm-hmm. the Tet Festival, big travel periods across Southeast Asia, across Asia.
Yeah.
And we also at the moment have the emergence, or hopefully not the emergence, but we have this coronavirus from China that we don't know quite what's happening with it. That we've already seen, I think, one case in Thailand, one case in Japan.
I think so.
Lots of cases in China. And this made me think going back over the last two decades. So in the 2003, we had SARS in the region, which really, really damaged the travel sector, obviously caused people a lot of pain and suffering, and also some deaths as well. In 2015, we had MERS, M-E-R-S, mm-hmm. which is the Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, which obliterated the tourism industry in South Korea.
Mm-hmm.
What made me think so much is if you go back to 2003, which, you know, it's almost two decades ago, we are seeing much bigger travel patterns around Southeast Asia, around Asia, within the region, in and out of the region, than we had at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if these viruses do become more entrenched, they will go global much faster.
Yes.
So I just think that let's be more aware. I think governments have to be more open about what is actually happening and where the cases actually are.
Yeah.
People with symptoms have to be obviously a little bit more aware.
Yes.
But just generally, I think health and safety, as climate change happens, as places get hotter and drier, I think we have to look after ourselves more significantly than perhaps we've done before. Yeah. And the corollary to that was that last year, Thailand was mulling requiring all travelers who enter the country to demonstrate that they have travel medical insurance because the numbers were of visitors were increasing so fast that if they were getting sick, it was putting a strain on the medical services. So, you know, these issues are actually already happening. I don't want to be too gloomy about it, but I just think we need to be a bit more aware that actually if you get sick while you're overseas, it is a burden on services, it is a burden on insurance companies. So,
there we go.
Let's all stay healthy. Let's all
stay healthy. So that brings down the curtain on our two-part 20 for the 2020s Travel Wishlist show. We hope you enjoyed our thoughts and comments and kind of gentle provocations. We'll post the full list on social media, and we'd love to get your feedback on the 20 travel wishes and hear your own travel hopes for the new decade. So please get in touch via Facebook at the SEA Travel Show, Twitter at SEA Travel Show, and our new Instagram feed at SEA Travel Show.
Yeah, I agree. There's plenty of food for thought there. Some of those items we might develop into theme podcasts for the show in the coming months. So please stay tuned. We'll let you know on that.
Mm.
You can follow us now on Spotify,
yes.
The Southeast Asia Travel Show, and hopefully we'll be on other pod platforms in the coming weeks.
And we'll have a brand new website and email newsletter coming very soon. Plus those few extra surprises I keep telling you about around the corner.
So thanks again for listening to our two-part 20 for the 2020s Travel Wishlist Show. Before we go, we'd like to wish all of our listeners a very happy Lunar New Year.
Yes, Gongxi Fa Cai. And we both adore the colours, music, and of course the foods of Chinese New Year and Tet celebrations. And we look forward to talking Southeast Asia travel again after the festive feasts.
Yeah, happy Lunar New Year.